This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and of course, once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com, and we want to thank you because we keep getting a stream of interesting and stimulating questions that trigger a lot of discussion. We appreciate that very much. How are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good. And for those of you new to this podcast, it's a question and answer format. Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin joins me each week to answer your questions. She's a registered dietitian. She also has earned a master's degree in the field of nutrition. So before we get to questions, I just want to note one of the stories this week, which is... headline, lifestyle intervention leads to 10-point drop in systolic blood pressure. Now, that would translate to say your blood pressure is 140 over 90. Mm-hmm. Well, the systolic is the first number, so get it down to 130 over presumably a lower diastolic number as well.
Yeah.
Because usually you can't drop your systolic without dropping your diastolic.
Yeah.
But that puts you from the... risk zone into the safe zone.
Yeah.
You know, so what they did here, it's interesting. This was, and this may be the future. So this may put us out of business because it's e-counseling.
E-counseling.
So in other words, what they did was they enrolled people with borderline blood pressure. It was like, I think, not super high. Mm-hmm. But and some of these people were on blood pressure medication, so they got their blood pressure to a level of 140 over 90.
Mm-hmm.
And then they enrolled them in a web-based lifestyle counseling program
mm-hmm.
that apparently was very well designed. It had like cartoons, and it had like weekly interaction, but it wasn't like individualized care like what we offer to patients when we sit with patients one-on-one. But then again, to have a weekly interaction with a patient over a period of a year, that could be expensive, and not everybody can afford that. Not everybody can logistically travel to the doctor's office, because we see patients from all over the, region and mm-hmm. even all over the country, mm-hmm. And sometimes from out of the country. So, we don't have that much weekly contact with patients. I mean, we can set that up. We can, encourage them, but usually that's not what happens.
Yeah.
So, and what they did is, and I don't think it was about vitamins or supplements, magic pills. It was about just the basics. I think stress reduction, exercise, and healthy diet.
Ah.
And what their version of a healthy diet is probably not too ambitious because I think we, probably ask a little more from our patients. We might put them on a paleo diet or a very low carb diet. I have a feeling they just put them on a kind of a DASH diet, sort of a low sodium diet with a lot more fruits and vegetables, low fat mm-hmm. dairy, blah, 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 the usual. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the exciting part about that, 10 point reduction, that's like blood pressure medication.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's that significant. And making the lifestyle changes is often the number one way to go if you were ever recently diagnosed a first time reading of high blood pressure. That should really be the first conversation that you have with your doctor. And I believe your doctor will give you a period of 2 or 3 months to say, okay, let's see if lifestyle measures work. And guess what? If you lose 5 to 7% of your weight, that will help bring down blood pressure.
And translate that to, say, the average 140-pound woman.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, 5% is 7 pounds, mm-hmm. 7 to 10 pounds, 5 to 7%. And in a male who's maybe 200 pounds, that's a 10-pound weight loss.
Right,
it's very achievable. So the other thing, and this is a different story, they also came up with a story that says that doctors who use, you know, the usual, they pump, you know, the hand pumped blood pressure cuff,
yes,
is inaccurate. And that now, it used to be that the hand pump was the gold standard, and the electronic ones were like, you know, you can do those at home, but come to the doctor's office for a real, you know, blood pressure determination.
Right.
Actually, what they're saying now is that the devices have gotten so good that using the sphygmometer, which is like that pump up thing, that is less accurate. The handheld devices are less accurate than the electronic devices. Then doctors should have electronic devices. And some of the consumer devices are probably maybe more accurate. So they actually estimate that 20% of people are diagnosed with high blood pressure when they don't really have high blood pressure unnecessarily because of the wrong devices. Plus, this, you know, going to a doctor's office and getting your blood pressure checked is not an ideal way of determining if you have high blood pressure because
white coat syndrome.
White coat syndrome. It's stressful to come to the doctor's office.
Right.
So, you know, maybe there's some overkill in the diagnosis.
There's another thing I want to mention to our listeners. You know, your doctor tells you to come in fasting, but most of you are having a cup of coffee or tea or other caffeinated beverages. You're not eating, so you're fasting, so to speak. That dose of caffeine is enough to raise your blood pressure. I've invited, I know at least one of our patients just 2 weeks ago, next time you go to the doctor, don't have any coffee that morning. Mm-hmm. Well, voila, she didn't have high blood pressure.
Yeah,
that reading.
Interesting.
So well, that could be something.
So
that
however,
may be for slow metabolizers.
However,
of
you know,
caffeine.
As we continue our stream of consciousness discussion here, now on the subject of coffee, studies actually show that coffee is not associated with high risk of stroke, and may be even preventive. Even though it may slightly raise blood pressure, there may be other protective effects of coffee.
Right.
And in addition, and this is a big surprise, atrial fibrillation, you think like a lot of coffee could make your heart palpitate. They did a study recently where they said, nah, it doesn't, you know. But
because it does, it helps prevent fibrosis or something. This was, I remember looking at that. And that's how coffee, the mechanism of action is that the caffeine itself may speed up and cause AFib. However, the coffee has some compound.
It makes you a healthier heart.
Exactly.
You
don't have a fibrotic.
Right. Now, I wonder if I'm doing myself any good by drinking all the decaf I drink. I'm probably getting some benefit
from
the polyphenols.
As long as it's a Swiss process, water process decaf,
Chemical
you're not
free.
Getting formaldehyde residues. Oh, my.
Right. Yep.
So you're almost better off drinking high test if you were just going with regular
methylene
decaf.
Chloride and nasty things like that.
You still get the polyphenols. We get small amounts of potassium in coffee, not enough to mention, as I just did, but
And then, you know, apropos of caffeine and caffeine-like beverages, there was a study that talks about this week about the benefits of tea.
Mm.
Daily consumption of tea protects the elderly from cognitive decline. And it didn't have to be green. It could just be tea.
Yeah. Regular old black tea or something.
Right. Because there's these catechins, of which EGCG is one, but there are other catechins that seem to be brain protective. So I can't get my head around tea, so I have to take EGCG capsules.
There you go. I love a cup of black tea. I love Earl Grey with the bergamot. The bergamot, which is very good for cholesterol, too.
Yes.
But for me, tea is a novelty. I have that as an occasional treat.
Just wrote an article on bergamot, which I guess...
Bergamot, yeah.
Bergamot. Maybe is the tea pronounced even? I think bergamot. Which is now a supplement that's available from us. And we had a very good outcome, which I described in the newsletter. We had a patient with wicked high cholesterol, somebody who has a familial susceptibility to high cholesterol. The 80 milligrams of Lipitor only brought it down to 417. That was as good as it got with the maximum dose of a statin. We added bergamot, just one pill twice daily. It went down to 327 in a month.
Amazing.
We're going to probably be using bergamot more in cardiovascular prevention. Plus, it has polyphenols that protect the arteries, so it works not just to lower cholesterol. So, okay, let's get to questions.
Wonderful. Okay. We've got an email all the way from South Africa.
Whoa.
Yeah. This comes from Marty. Marty, I believe this is a she, ends with an I, T-I. I live in South Africa and just read an article regarding green smoothies, which then led to hypothyroidism.
Okay.
Anyway, So that's interesting. Well, I think what Marty is referring to, green smoothies, meaning, you know, kale or anything like that.
Right.
A lot of people are making smoothies out of kale, which can be a big goitrogen.
A goitrogen, which interferes with thyroid metabolism.
So Marty in South Africa takes Eltroxin every day, which is levothyroxin.
Okay.
But it seems I might be allergic to it. Causes dry skin and burning itchy skin. Mm. I once went abroad and forgot to take my tablets with me, and I couldn't believe the difference in my skin's dryness and lack of itchiness and burning.
Right.
Is there an alternative I could take, bearing in mind I am in sunny South Africa?
Yeah, it's a little bit, it's a little hard to discern why it is that that medication would cause dry skin, because actually a hallmark of hypothyroidism is dry skin.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you take thyroid medication, it should alleviate that.
Right.
So is it possible she's allergic to the thyroxin? It's unlikely for you to be allergic to the chemical, the actual thyroid hormone in it. It could be the carrier. And so sometimes to code the different dosages, there are different dyes used in that. And so for some of our patients, they claim that they're having allergic symptoms due to the dye, the yellow or red or blue dye that is used in these pills to color code them. You know, so you know whether it's a 75 or 100 or 125. Mm-hmm. Different colors denote the potency. So what we then have to do is we give them allergen-free versions of that, which have to be compounded specially in order to avoid that allergy component. I think there's a brand of thyroid that is actually designed for people who are allergic to thyroid.
Hmm.
To the fillers or the colorings.
Because dry, burning, itchy skin, that sounds like an allergic reaction almost.
So there are constituents in standard thyroid medications. There's been concern about people being sensitive to gluten. There's certainly cornstarch in some of these medications, colorings, and coatings and dyes. And so, you know, you may want to switch to a natural thyroid medication that's allergen-free. The companies that make natural thyroid are often more scrupulous about avoiding potential allergens in the mix of ingredients.
Yeah. Marty, so, check back in with your endocrinologist and see if you...
Yeah, check with your endocrinologist to see if there's an alternative.
Great idea. Marty, best of luck to you in South Africa. Thank you for your email.
It's gratifying to hear we have listeners all over the world through the miracle of the internet.
Wonderful. Okay. We've got another email here. This one is from Germany. This is from Franziska, who's had a particular medical issue, which is very long and needing a consult, so I've kind of put the questions in a nutshell. What is your take, Dr. Hoffman, on stem cells and how well they can differentiate? Is it true that they won't always differentiate well?
Well, this is exactly the crux of stem cell research. And, you know, there's a big, big controversy going on now about stem cells, because more and more doctors who, even my type of doctor, integrative doctors, are embracing stem cells as sort of a panacea treatment. You know, we're always looking for ways to get our patients better. So in sincerity, I mean, we see a lot of patients who are very stuck with very dramatic problems like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, or organ failure. And so, you know, they go around to conventional doctors. Conventional doctors say, look, we can't, you know, it's a Humpty Dumpty problem. There's no fix for this. It's like, you are beyond repair. So they hear about remarkable regenerative medicine, which is stem cells, where you can literally regenerate the function of organs. You know, if you're blind, you can put in new retinal cells. Or if you, have liver failure, you can inject some cells and regrow a liver. And, you know, you can put in, you have congestive heart failure, you can regenerate your cardiomyocytes. And, you know, it's all wonderful theoretically.
Yeah.
However, the researchers are really working on this, and they're spending, multi-millions of dollars in research. And what the trick is to get these cells, which are pluripotent. They have the potential to go any way they want. They're in an early stage of development. They're called stem cells.
Yeah.
Pluripotent means that they can develop into eye tissue, they can develop into lung tissue, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they have to be coaxed along to that, to do that.
I see.
And so merely to inject stem cells and say, you know, take them from your tummy, you know, from fat,
yeah,
fat stem cells, or from your bone marrow where there are stem cells, and just inject them willy-nilly into the body doesn't necessarily make them go where they need to go. I mean, on a wing and a prayer, maybe. So there was a big, big problem with this lately. It's in the news, is that three women went to a clinic in Florida which mm-hmm. offers stem cells, and they had macular degeneration, which means they still had some vision, but their vision was decreasing, and they wanted to reverse that.
Mm-hmm.
So they sucked out some stem cells from their tummies. They spun it down. They, you know, probably, you know, suspended the cells in some matrix of compound or something like that, and then shot it back into their eyeballs. And now, one of three, I think two of three are completely blind, and one is like virtually blind.
Oh,
because
my.
It literally homogenized the insides of their eyeballs. And it created bleeding, and it created retinal detachment, and it created glaucoma, and their eyes are a mess from that.
Wow.
So, now, the New England Journal did a very interesting article. They said, contrast that mm-hmm. with the bona fide research that is going on regenerating eyes. And what they did is very carefully, they obtained from skin fibroblasts of a patient.
Uh-huh.
They cultivated from these progenitor cells for skin mm-hmm. before the cells differentiated a special type of retinal cell. And they went through some very, very complicated process to clone these cells, in effect. Mm-hmm. They then did a very careful genetic analysis to see if they were on the right track, if they're creating the right cells. And then they injected it into the eyeball of just one patient. And by the way, these patients paid good money for this.
I'll bet.
They paid, you know, thousands of dollars for the treatment that rendered them blind. In this research study, which was experimental, so there was no charge to the patient, which is ethically correct,
mm-hmm.
because the patient's a research subject. Why charge somebody who's, you know, in research? You know, so it worked. It somewhat restored vision. It actually did work. But this is, they actually created, like sheets of retinal cells. Almost like the way, you know, when you go to a sod farm, you know, and they create like sheets of lawn,
mm-hmm.
and then they come, you know, they come
they
with a truck and they roll it up and they give you your instant lawn,
mm-hmm.
you know. That's what they did with those cells. So they created this very carefully.
Wow.
They were even so conservative as to the second patient who was eligible for this. They said, we tested it out. We didn't like something that we saw in the test tube. So
mm-hmm.
we're not even going to subject that person to the treatment because it might be risky. So this is true scientific conservatism, the right spirit of scientific research, contrasted with what is basically entrepreneurial science.
Yeah,
you know, the aura of science, the aura of magic,
mm-hmm.
Coupled with charlatanism or greed or jumping the gun at mm-hmm. best, you know, with mm-hmm. offering patients a therapy that's half-baked and not right yet.
Wow.
And so I just have to, a lot of our listeners, they listen to all kinds of media and, you know, they hear it on the radio or they read articles and these articles basically say, come hither and get your, you know, throw off your disability and, you know, rejuvenate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, a false promise.
Wow.
It's too soon. And I predict that within a couple of years, the FDA will really clamp down on some of these clinics.
Is there any danger of these stem cells causing cancer?
That's true, too. I mean, that's another thing. In one case, they had, and I wrote about this in a recent article,
mm-hmm.
They injected stem cells into a spine of a patient who had paralysis, and it caused some very unusual cancer that is rarely seen because these stem cells are primitive. And actually, when cancer is hard to treat, that's when it becomes like a stem cell. So the stem cells can grow chaotically instead of in an organized fashion. In an organized fashion, you get retinal cells or you get, you know, spinal neurons.
You get differentiated cells.
But if you get cells that are like a massive, you know, mixed up spaghetti, then it's cancer.
Yeah, yeah. Transformed and immortalized and oof.
Yeah,
wow.
And without the ability to stop replicating, which is the characteristic of cancer.
That's fascinating. Wow. So it's not ready to happen, right, apparently, anytime soon.
It used to be that you had to go offshore to India or to Mexico or, you know, to get these. Now you can get these treatments in the United States at some places. There's a little less controversy. Well, there's still controversy about stem cells being injected into joints. I think that's less bad.
Okay.
Some people claim it works, but there's a very high degree of placebo when it comes to getting an injection in your joint.
Okay.
So that it, according to studies, that hasn't even been proven out.
Wow.
And I think what in the future they'll be able to create some kind of scaffolding that they'll put cells into, and the cells will grow and regenerate, and then they'll implant that. But that's a very sophisticated prep, not just, pull some stem cells out, put in a centrifuge, and shoot it back into your knee.
Wow. Franziska, wow, thank you for your email, all the way from Germany.
Yeah.
We wish you the best of luck. All right, wow.
Yeah.
So.
I think a trip to Germany might be in the offing for me soon, because I'd love to see what they're doing over there. They really have some very remarkable, innovative, integrative medicine clinics there. It's a very well-established part of their medical system.
That is, I'll tell you, my father was a rectal cancer patient there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He actually traveled to the, I forget the name of the institute, but it's in Bad Aibling near Munich.
Yeah.
And he went there for hyperthermia.
Uh-huh. Which is something that's...
Very well.
Yeah, which is something they really should be doing more of in the States.
Yeah.
And that the Germans are known for hyperthermia. They're they're known for various types of immunological serums that they derive from people's blood, and they, you know, create some immune-boosting cocktail that they put back into you.
And this was in the years 1999-2000. There. Anyway. All right. We've got an email here from Jessica. Hello. I was grateful to find Dr. Hoffman's article on supplements for GERD. I've been following his recommended protocol for a week and notice a difference.
Yay.
Yay. Are there other things I can take, and are there reasons that you like one particular supplement over another?
Do you see where she's going with that?
Well, actually, she's asking, is there any reason why Glutagenix, which also contains DGL and aloe, is not recommended, and they're the same maker as Endofen? Jessica, no particular reason. Is what I've found, what I've observed, is that most people, especially with intractable GERD, fare much better with Endofen than any other product that I've come across so far. But there's no reason. It's not that the other product may be bad or anything else. It's that our experience has been...
Putting a plug for that is that we are a source for Endofen. You can go to drhoffman.com and order Endofen, or call our office for information and have it sent to you.
Yeah. But there may be, you know, other supplements out there that contain some of these same ingredients that may work, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But definitely DGL, definitely what's in Endofen, like apple powder and EGCG, astaxanthin, marshmallow.
If we did like a pie chart or you know, sort of a time allocation chart for what we do here, you know, a lot of it is education, like these podcasts. We're doing this during office hours, you know, between patients. And a lot of it is reading and studying and, you know, kind of keeping up on the latest developments. A lot of it is writing, you know, because we both write. And we both broadcast, you know, individually. And a lot of it, of course, is patient care. You know, maybe 60% is patient care. But I would say about 5%, a good chunk of it, is vetting products.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and look constantly on the lookout for, you know, this is new. Is this worthwhile? Is this better than something we're now using?
Yep.
Is it more cost effective? Can we improve on our offerings?
Right.
And so, you know, and then we'll kind of compare notes. Sometimes we'll try something. I'll say, Layla, did that work for a patient?
Right.
So, for example, you have more experience with people's response to Endafin. I just said, oh, that sounds good. And then you're using it a lot with our GERD patients.
Yeah.
And I hear the feedback from you that it's
pretty
effective.
I actually learned about that product from a patient, very, very difficult case that where nothing cured her GERD except for Endafin. And I immediately went out, you know, looking for that.
Good.
So, yeah. And ever since, and that was many years ago, ever since, most everybody's done well.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Jessica, take your GERD supplements. We're glad you're feeling better. Okay.
Excellent. We're going to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And so, Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to see in part two.
I have found the answer, the antidote to my irritated bladder and burning urination, otherwise known as interstitial cystitis.
Oh, wow. Okay, we're going to get the answer in part two. So we'll keep you in suspense. Stay tuned, and please flip the LP to side two. Those of you who remember what that is. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.